Steam Ace Finn Ginnandonic, 102.5, 106.3 The Game. Broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. And we are presented by Bet365. Whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here with you. Derek Mason out today. He will be back later this week as we celebrate Derek and his induction into the Tennessee Sports Hall of Fame. Jason Big Joe will be on from noon to 3. They are live from SEC Media Days in Atlanta. Our coverage is sponsored by Brewhouse South. Experience Nashville's ultimate sports and brew hangout at Brewhouse South in Cool Springs. We've also recently learned that SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey will join Jason Big Joe tomorrow at 12:45. So be sure to listen to that. So my question for all you Vols fans out there at 615-737-1025, Tennessee is at SEC Media Days today. No quarterbacks addressing reporters. But now that we are 3 months removed from all of the Nico Iamaleh drama, which I am now going to make a thing 3 months too late, how are Tennessee fans feeling about the team and the quarterback situation now that the season is upon us? Because, as I said, I seem to recall a lot of you Vols fans saying, hey, I'm willing to have a disappointing season because Tennessee did the right thing by not acquiescing to Iamaleava's reported NIL demands. Terrell on our text line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com says, as a Vol fan, I will give them grace. In football, there are surprises. For example, Hendon Hooker. My question has been, with the way things worked out, if Tennessee had paid him, would he still had transferred? I think he wanted to play near his home and forced the situation. One texter says, to be fair, I was nervous about the season even with Nico. It's an entire new offensive line and quite a bit of roster turnover overall.
I think that was going to be my follow-up question to the Tennessee fan base who follows this to the last detail. And that is there less pressure on Aguilar because of this whole thing of this is a year where you have to put it in context. They did what they did. I think across college football, they did the right thing. You cannot be held hostage by one player. That's admirable. And they were willing to take a step back if that's what's necessary. But I think that also relieves the pressure on Aguilar. Although the expectations will still, I think that's the pull, right? You still are expected to win at Tennessee.
Paul Feinbaum was on Robbie and Rex Road this morning. Robbie Stanley asked Paul Feinbaum about this. Here's what he said.
When you're going 7-5 or 8-4 this year, and we'll see what happens on that front. But what do you make of kind of the situation Tennessee's in at quarterback and where you think this may be headed?
Well, number one, Josh Heupel got a lot of credit for something he really had very little to do with. I mean, the guy walked out. So let's be real. He didn't kick him out. He didn't show up for practice, and the school did the only thing they could. And I understand why everybody praised Heupel, because I was part of that group, but you're completely correct. If Tennessee's slumping toward a 7-5 season, nobody's going to remember that and nobody's going to care. But I really don't think that's going to happen. I frankly think Tennessee has an upgrade in Joey Aguilar. I don't think he's got the raw ability that Nico did, but I think he wants to be there, and I think he will be a better whole package at quarterback, and I never understood all the fascination with Nico other than the money. I mean, that, you know, from day one, that's all we heard about, how much money he was making. But outside of a couple of plays, what did he do at Tennessee?
That was Paul Feinbaum this morning on Robbie and Rex Road.
I think it's a Paul Feinbaum-esque stretch to make the statement they might be better on the front end. Because I don't know what he's basing that on. I haven't gone back through the tape of Aguilar. I would be interested in listening to somebody who has done exactly that, evaluated Aguilar. Because Appalachian State is not chopped liver. The Sun Belt is kind of a rising conference, I think. It's raised its profile. And Appalachian State, historically, has won a lot of football games. So that's what I don't know about Aguilar. When you take a guy from a program like that who's played a lot and he's older, now you put him around SEC talent, presumably a lot better talent than he's had around him. Does that allow him to turn the ball over less? That was a good discussion that Robbie and Joe had this morning. because that's the key. If you look at his stats, that's one thing that jumps out at you with Aguilar. He's thrown a lot of interceptions, more than he's going to be able to get away with if he's going to hold that job at Tennessee, because they've got two young, highly recruited quarterbacks that they're hoping turn into something, but they're really young. And so that will become the question if Aguilar can't get it done early is, well, let's see what the young kid can do. And that could be a dilemma that can have your season going a number of different directions.
So Adam Sparks, my former colleague at the Tennessean, now at the Knoxville News Sentinel, had a bit of a Q&A about the quarterback situation at Tennessee. One of the questions was, what are the chances that Jake Merklinger beats out Joey Aguilar? Sparks writes, quote, I'd put my money on Aguilar starting the opener against Syracuse, but that could change in preseason practice. It will be a legitimately wide-open competition, which could stretch into the season. In 2021, Joe Milton transferred to UT after spring practice and started the first two games, but Hendon Hooker ultimately won the job. These quarterbacks in this situation aren't the same, but they're similar. Even if Aguilar initially wins the job, he'll have to play well to keep Merklinger off the field. The next question from Sparks is, why didn't Josh Heupel stick with Merklinger rather than add Aguilar? And Sparks writes, quote, it wasn't a binary decision. After Iamaliava transferred to UCLA, the Vols had only two quarterbacks and needed to add a third. Aguilar was the most accomplished quarterback to enter the portal in the spring aside from Iamaliava, so UT got him. Not adding a quarterback wasn't an option, and adding a lesser quarterback would have been foolish. Coach Josh Heupel hasn't abandoned Merklinger. If he outperforms Aguilar and demonstrates a better grasp of the offense, Merklinger will start.
I think that's a really good assessment, and it does illustrate how limited the options were. Aguilar was the only option, it seemed like. And only is a strong term, but he was clearly the best of the lot. If that had happened, if all of the drama had happened in January and not in the spring, I think they would have probably selected a different quarterback, right? With the money they would have had and the number of people in the portal, that might have been a different animal for sure, despite all the drama. And Tennessee fans would have they would have easily been able to brush their hands and say, okay, get out of here, Nico. We've got so-and-so. But Nico put him behind the eight ball because the pool of quarterbacks to select wasn't very big. So that's the mystery of Aguilar, is he the right guy? Because we see a lot. Let's take Vanderbilt. In basketball, who were the guys that turned the team around from a terrible team who fired their coach with a brand new roster? They weren't guys that came from all Power 5 conferences. Yeah, they did have a guy from Michigan State, right? But they had guys from North Texas, Cornell, other mid-major schools. So that is the thing that I think we couldn't have predicted 3 or 4 years ago, is that the mid-major guy on the way up, you get a label of mid-major. Oftentimes, that's a guy that is really a high-end player that just happened to be developing at a slower rate when he's out of high school, right? So is Aguilar one of those guys? I don't know. But there's been a lot of guys like him that have come from Appalachian State or a team that doesn't sound sexy and done really well in the SEC in all sports, football, basketball, and baseball for sure.
And as we know, the SEC is an entirely different beast than,
of course,
the Sun Belt.
Of course.
Of course. And you can't fully understand what playing in the SEC is like until you actually do it. So I'm looking at Tennessee's schedule, and let's assume that Aguilar wins the starting job. His third game will be a home date against Georgia on September 13th. They start August 30th against Syracuse at a neutral site game. I want to say that game is in Atlanta.
Yes.
And then they host East Tennessee State before hosting Georgia. Tennessee doesn't go on the road until September 27th. That's their fifth game at Mississippi State. They're at Alabama, however, on October 18th. So if Aguilar is the starting quarterback, week three at home against Georgia, that'll be his first real taste of SEC action. But in terms of being on the road, that won't come until week seven, I guess, if I'm counting right, against Alabama.
Yeah, I noticed that Pat Forty wrote a really good column. He did a big, long dive into the college football schedule as a whole, and that was one thing he noted. Tennessee is among the teams in the country that have the most games at home before they go on the road. And so that is, on paper, an advantage. You can develop some things, work some things out, especially if you have a new quarterback situation. That's an advantage for Tennessee that they need to take advantage, that they need to, you know, capitalize on.
Austin on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, excuse me, says, I feel okay about the team and the quarterback situation. I think there will be a slight step back, but we'll get back on course. So I'm wondering if, this is a small sample, but it certainly sounds like some of you Vols fans out there would accept a step back this season, considering the quarterback situation. I want to know what that feels like in season. It's different to say it now.
And I think this is what we try to do now, and then come back to this discussion in the middle of September or October.
Yes,
when it goes a different way, because I was saying all summer last year for the Titans, hey, this is a rebuild. This is a rebuild, and then people were really mad when they were as poor as they were last year, because they're like, they told us they were going to be competitive. So it's harder in the moment to accept that you are, quote, taking a step back.
To your point.
And you have to, and it was not something you chose to do. They're having to do that based on the drama of Nico. What did you call it?
The Iamale drama. Yeah, I'm really disappointed in myself that it took me until July 15th to come up with that.
I think you need to get that to Chase and Big Joe. Have them swirl that around.
Yes.
In Atlanta. See, you could do this. We could do this ourselves if we were there, but we're just not there. So we need Chase and Big Joe to carry the message.
To your point, from that column from Pat 40 on the college football schedule, power conference teams that go the farthest into the season before playing a true road game. Missouri in its seventh game. Nebraska.
Seventh game.
Missouri in its seventh game. Nebraska in its sixth. Tennessee, Penn State, Indiana, Rutgers, Miami, Virginia Tech, and Wake Forest in their fifth.
Okay.
I need to look at Missouri's schedule now.
What the heck is going on with Missouri? How did they get all that? Six games straight without playing a road game?
Let's take a look. Missouri schedule. All right. They open the season at home against Central Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, South Carolina, Massachusetts, and Alabama. Their first true road game is at Auburn on October 18th.
So wait a minute. Is it four straight non-conference games to start the year?
Central Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana. So three. Then South Carolina.
Okay.
In game four. Massachusetts, okay. UMass. And then Alabama at home on October 11th before going to Auburn on the 18th of October and Vanderbilt on the 25th of October.
So they bought some home games so that they don't go on the road. There are some teams, and Vanderbilt got burned with this last year. Rather than pay big money to buy a win at home, they went to Georgia State thinking we should be able to win at Georgia State, and they didn't. But that does happen sometimes if you want to put your schedule out there. That's why the scheduling is such a big, important point with the committee, because we need to put aside the traditional ways that we evaluate the schedule if you're trying to make the playoff. If you're just trying to get to a bowl game, which some years Missouri has been that kind of team, then purchasing and making sure you're playing four non-conference home games, that's good. It's going to get you W's. That should be noted, though, if you're strength of schedule and you're on the bubble for the committee.
Here's another interesting SEC schedule note. Arkansas plays just one of its first four games in Fayetteville and faces a couple of little brother programs that would love to take down the Razorbacks early in Memphis on the road and Arkansas State in Little Rock. Three 2024 playoff teams are on the docket in Notre Dame, Tennessee, and Texas. These will be the first ever meetings between the Hogs in both Arkansas State and Notre Dame.
This is a point that James Franklin used to make all the time about the schedule. There's no bowl game. Let's say you're not in the playoffs, but you want to be bowl eligible. Well, there's one requirement. You got to win six games, right? And then there's the special circumstances or whatever. Sometimes, occasionally, a team gets in there with five. But you got to win six. There is no strength of schedule component. So let's take those two schedules, Missouri and Arkansas. if they both ended up 5-7, or they both ended up 6-6, or even Arkansas goes 5-7 with that schedule, not playing a home game until when? They don't play. They play in Fayetteville when for the first time?
Well, they open at home.
It's in Little Rock or something.
So they open at home against Alabama A&M.
Right, but it's not in Fayetteville. Right? Don't they play a game in Little Rock? Either way.
Yes.
They don't take into account for bowl games where the games are played or who you played. That's why these teams in the SEC will, a lot of those teams will always say, let's play eight and let us decide who we want to play in the four non-conference games. And if you want to schedule cupcakes or play at home to build wins so you have a better pathway of at least getting to a bowl game, you should be able to do that.
I'm looking up the Arkansas.
It'd be nice if you could, if the committee would say, well, you know, that team ended up 4-8, but man, they played the second toughest schedule in the country. They're a good team. Let's put them in the bowl game. That's not how it works.
So Arkansas plays just one of its first four games in Fayetteville. Takes on Memphis on the road and Arkansas State in Little Rock. They also play at Ole Miss on September 13th before hosting Notre Dame on September 27th and visiting Tennessee on October 11th.
The schedule is a huge thing that we talk about every summer. Lane Kiffin said this yesterday on the SEC Network. He said, we get way too concerned of whether you have two losses, three losses, one loss. He said last year he felt like his Ole Miss team would have beaten the previous year's Ole Miss team by 10 points. But that team had less losses and went to a better bowl game. It was before the playoff system. This past year's team lost the third game. Like they famously came up short against Florida in a game that they needed to win to stay in the playoff hunt. But one team's record was better than the other, but he thought that the team with the worst record was way better. Way better. But it doesn't get factored in to when we evaluate college football seasons.
615-737-1025. We will take your thoughts on the Tennessee Volunteers. It is Tennessee Day at SEC Media Days. After all, once again, Chase and Big Joe live from SEC Media Days all week long from noon to 3. And our coverage is sponsored by Brewhouse South. Experience Nashville's ultimate sports and brew. Hang out at Brewhouse South in Cool Springs. 615-737-1025. Coming up next. A week from today, Tennessee Titans rookies and veterans report to training camp and will be all Titans, Titans, Titans as I punch my microphone. I'm so excited. Titans, 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 Titans. So I want to take a moment to talk about some of the other major training camp storylines around the NFL and which ones interest us and interest you the most. So at 615-737-1025, you can let us know which training camp storylines in the NFL outside of Tennessee interest you most. We'll discuss those coming up next. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025, 1063, The Game. This isn't just a concert, it's a cause. Trintix's Rock the Cradle helps give fragile newborns a stronger start and keeps moms close when it matters most. With Tim McGraw live on stage and your support behind every beat, Ascension St. Thomas is turning music into healing. Tickets are on sale now at rockthecradlenashville.org. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here with you. Let's switch gears to the NFL. As I said, a week from today, July 22nd, Tennessee Titans rookies and veterans will report to training camp. We are 1 week away from Titans training camp, but there are other teams in the NFL, of course. And since we are going to be so focused on the Titans starting next week, I wanted to take this time, Willie, to look around the NFL and discuss other training camp storylines that also intrigue us and you as well at 615-737-1025. So when I ask you that question, really, which training camp storyline outside of Nashville interests you most? Which team, which storyline comes to mind for you?
The one that jumps out at me is the Patriots, because I'm very curious about the Vrabel, and I'm also very curious about the pathway of Drake May, because I think there's some parallels to Drake May and the season he had last year and what we think we might see from Cam Ward this year. I think Drake May in a fishbowl with a big fan base that's done a lot, as we know, they stunk. But he shined through where the fan base is mostly saying, okay, it's not him. He looks pretty good. We just need to get the pieces around him. Now they've gone and they've hired Mike Vrabel. They made the controversial decision to throw Jerod Mayo, a University of Tennessee guy, to the Wolves and just say, you know, we put everything on him. And they, let's not even get into that, but it was not your normal way that you do it. You crown this guy as the successor to a legend, and you give him 1 year when you knew your team's going to be bad. Then you make a change. So there's pressure on Vrabel, I think, to show immediate improvement. So for all those reasons, and the obvious, of course, is in this town, people are very curious to see how Vrabel does. It probably won't reflect well on the Titans, Amy Adams on down, if Vrabel immediately does well for New England. So for me, it's New England without a doubt.
By the way, week 7, October 19th, noon, Patriots at Titans. I wonder what we'll be talking about that week. That is a good choice. The first team that comes to mind for me, and I acknowledge that I'm probably influenced by how much I see Aaron Rodgers' face on my television, is the Pittsburgh Steelers. They have had a very un-Steeler-like offseason. They bring in Aaron Rodgers, the worst-kept secret in the NFL, and he's joining a team that also traded for Jalen Ramsey and a team that also traded for DK Metcalf. And they're an older team. Cam Hayward is pushing 40. Jalen Ramsey is 31, but, you know, that's sort of old in NFL terms.
It is.
Even DK Metcalf, who's in his late 20s, has been in the league for, what, 6-7 years at this point.
It's hard to believe.
I'm curious just about how this is all going to work. There's the Aaron Rodgers of it all, playing for a stable organization, unlike his previous employer, the antithesis of a stable organization.
Jets?
Right? I'm curious about that. I'm curious about the dynamic between Rodgers and Tomlin. And I'm also curious about how far the Steelers think they can go. Because the Steelers, and we're going to talk about rebuilding later in the program, the Steelers are the team that they'll always be in the mix. Mike Tomlin's never had a losing season, if I'm correct, right?
That's correct.
As coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers, he's never had a losing season. They're always just good enough to sneak into the playoffs. Maybe they just miss the playoffs, but they get in there as the seventh seed in the AFC, and they're, you know, they're, to use your term, they're thrown to the wolves.
Yeah,
but to the second seed in the AFC.
Very tough division, so you have to give them that. But yeah, they are a very intriguing team for all those reasons.
This feels like we're going all in for 1 year sort of thing. And how successful can the Steelers be, especially in that division, which is ruled by the Baltimore Ravens?
Yes, there's no question that that's going to be a big drama from day one. There is just how they get along, and how much of a, I don't know if I would say it's an actual one, but it's going to be some version of a power struggle, right? Whether they intend for it to be or not, even if both sides come in with the right attitude, there's going to be some friction between how Aaron Rodgers has always done things and brought in his guys and the way the Steelers have always done things, the Steeler way. One thing that you have been able to count on, that as all of the things have evolved in the NFL over the last 30 years, the Steelers do things their way, for better or worse, right? So how do those two mix? It's going to be a great thing to watch.
The other storyline that fascinates me, we'll keep it in the AFC South, is how the Jacksonville Jaguars divvy up,
yes,
Travis Hunter's workload in training camp. And Albert Breer wrote about this for Sports Illustrated. He said, quote, Jacksonville's already on the record saying his baseline, meaning Hunter's baseline, will be first on offense, which matches the background of the new guys in charge. Liam Cohen is an offensive coach, and he will be the Jags play caller. GM James Gladstone, a.k.a. Doogie Howser, comes from a Rams franchise that...
Does it say that in the article?
It does not. That was my own editorializing. James Gladstone comes from a Rams franchise that consistently invested in the receiver position and of late, post-Jalen Ramsey, had pulled back on what it was spending on corners. And that is how the spring went. Hunter's first 3 weeks or so after being drafted were devoted to playing offense and learning Cohen's scheme. After that, the coaches started to integrate defensive work into his day. So I am interested to see how much time Travis Hunter spends on offense and defense during Jaguars training camp.
You touched on something that it gives me a thought I hadn't had so far. My thought in the big picture is, can you physically do it, play on both sides of the ball? We've had a lot of discussions about that. And if you try to do it, how long are you going to last and how effective are you going to be? Even if you're effective, will your body wear down? All of those questions. I didn't think about this part of it, because D-Mace was pretty consistent throughout the evaluation process that he thought you'd be better off playing him as a full-time corner. And I think a lot of people echoed D-Mace's sentiment. Full-time corner, spot him on offense. We just talked to, Martell Height,
yes.
For Vanderbilt. They announced he's been a defensive back and kick returner. They're going to sprinkle him in on offense. That's different than saying he's an offensive player that we're also going to play on defense. But I hadn't thought about this. You called him Doogie Howser, right?
Doogie Howser, yes. He's
the new coaching staff is all offense. So the coaching staff is coming in and they're salivating. I'm the head coach. Where do we want our first round pick? I'm playing him on offense. Like it's a self-serving thing almost. Is that really the best thing for the team? I hadn't considered that. Are they biased by saying, well, let's put him on offense because, you know, they look at the offense without him and like, what are we going to do if we don't have a first round pick that's offense? So let's lean him that way. I wonder how that affected the decision.
Albert Breer continues, quote, "What's really interesting is how different it is from Hunter's setup at Colorado and how just about every team I talked to pre-draft would have drawn it up for him. Over 2 years in Boulder, the overwhelming majority of Hunter's meeting and practice time was spent on defense.
Right.
That's because it's much easier to have things built in for a player without fully integrating him on offense than it is on defense. The offensive coaches would put in packages for Hunter and fill in the blanks by signaling in routes to him from the sideline. Of course, that wouldn't be the only way to do it, but it would be hard, if not impossible, to start a guy on an NFL defense without that player spending a significant amount of his time preparing on a week-to-week basis for opponents on the defensive side."
It's another great point that I have thought of, and I don't know what it's like in these meeting rooms, but can you imagine the amount of time he's going to have to spend in the meeting rooms? In theory, you would need to spend double the amount of time in the meeting rooms just to be even with everybody else on the team. Talking about a rookie.
Better get a sleeping bag.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, how do you, what do you do with the rest of your life? Do you just live in the facility? You got to have a life and time to get away from it sometime.
I'm glad that Travis Hunter is in the AFC South because I'll be paying attention to him more.
Right.
And I am incredibly curious about how all of this is going to go.
Last week we had our fun throwback, right? We did our rewatchable,
yes,
of a game from the 80s. I would venture to say that the game was a little simpler back then, right? I look at myself as a guy that was somehow managed to play two sports in the SEC, and I ask myself, could you do that today? I think, and I think I'm the last guy in the SEC to do it, as many reps as I did. Not that I lit it up in either one, but I played significantly. But I think with all that's asked of an athlete today, I don't think you could do it now. And that's why I wonder about Hunter, with all of the details that you have in a defensive system. Like, you have to simplify one or the other. And they're choosing, I think, to simplify his plate on defense, if I'm reading Breer right here. Like, if you're a two-sport athlete now, you cannot physically play the travel schedule in two different sports. They're going to overlap. There's too many. You're going to burn out. There's not enough time in the day. You can't physically be there. So is he an offensive player that dabbles in the defense? I just don't think you could be full-time in both and fully integrated, to use that term, in both. There's just not enough hours in the day.
615-737-1025. Our phone and text lines are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Which NFL training camp storylines outside of Nashville interest you most as teams start reporting for training camp over the next week? 615-737-1025. We will continue this coming up next. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025, 1063, The Game. D-Mace Vingan and Donick, 1025, 1063, The Game. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here with you. By the way, Willie, Tom in Nashville on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, texted in a link to an article on AL.com written in 2019, 22 notable multi-sport athletes in SEC history. And I regret to inform you that you're not on it.
No. I am talking, when I mentioned myself, I'm only talking specifically basketball and baseball, not two sport athletes in general. I didn't mean to imply I was the last two-sport athlete in the SEC. But if you look at baseball and basketball specifically, and then if you want to cut it a little finer, two-way baseball and basketball, then I think I'm the last guy to do those things.
You are the finest multi-sport athlete I know.
Well, there's that. There's that.
You are the only one I know, but that is why you're the best.
Okay. Who are the notable two-sport athletes that they mentioned there?
Let me pull up this article.
Bo Jackson's one of them.
It was written in 2019. Let me see here.
Bo Jackson, unbelievable, yeah. Football, baseball is probably the most common
two-sport athlete. James Winston was like that,
and then there's
too.
There's football track is another one that's fairly common.
I believe Todd Helton was on this list.
Todd Helton, football, baseball, yeah.
That was the only name I recognized right off the jump.
Yeah. There was a guy that I played against. His name was Matt Blunden, who was he was the quarterback for Virginia, some really good Virginia teams. And I think he even played a bowl game against Tennessee when I was in school, early 90s. And he was also a pretty good basketball player. So football, basketball, occasionally. Julius Peppers comes to mind.
Yes.
Charlie Ward, of course. But he's not SEC. But
Maurice Hampton, whenever he was at LSU, he played both baseball and football. But then once he transferred, he just stayed with football.
Yeah, there's been quite a few baseball, football through the years. Basketball, baseball. I want to hear that list.
Okay.
I got my hand up to my ear. Who you got?
At the moment, I don't have anybody.
The one I do know is Willie Donick.
There you go. This another thing we need to circulate through the SEC media days. Even though it's football media days.
Maybe, Chase, if you're listening, just put on our show, turn up the
Jordan
speaker.
Jordan Rogers got his start at 102.5 The Game. Adam's got his...
Iamali drama.
We got the terminology for the Nico drama, the Iamali drama. And now, Donick, was he the last two-sport athlete in specifically baseball and basketball?
Specifically. Remember that.
Specifically. Baseball, basketball.
That's an important distinction.
Yes.
So another training camp storyline around the NFL outside of Nashville that I'm interested in, the follow-up seasons for the top rookie quarterbacks from last season. You mentioned Drake May, Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels. You can also throw in Michael Penix now that Michael Penix is getting his first real appointment as an NFL starter with the Atlanta Falcons. J.J. McCarthy is set to... pilot a loaded offense after missing all of last year with a knee injury. So I am curious about all five of those quarterbacks and what they will be able to do in their sophomore seasons. Specifically, McCarthy. He didn't have a rookie season because he injured his knee in the preseason. He did not play all of last season. And they made the decision, the Vikings, that is.
The decision. It wasn't a LeBron the decision, but that was a big decision.
That was a big decision to move on from Sam Darnold after Sam Darnold had an outstanding season with the Vikings. And the Vikings are putting a lot of faith in J.J. McCarthy, whom they drafted, number 10 overall last year, that they can plug and play and keep things going with McCarthy. So that is one I'm focused on. But I am curious about Caleb Williams as well, now that he has Ben Johnson as his head coach. So of those five second-year quarterbacks, Willie, you mentioned Drake May already. Which one of them intrigues you most as the season begins?
I think it's McCarthy for the reasons we said, because there is so much there's so much riding on that. When they had last year at this time, we weren't really talking about the Vikings as a team that was supposed to contend. There was a lot more stock being bought in the Bears, right? In that division, there was a lot of, hey, the Bears could be that rare team that spent a lot of money in free agency. They've been picking high. Now they get the rookie quarterback. They're that rare team that could make a jump with a rookie quarterback. It was much more about them than it was the Vikings. They were the other team in the division. We already knew about two really good teams in the Lions and the Packers. And so now the expectation level is changed for the Vikings after the year that they had last year. And now the bar is set high. I don't know how it's pretty, let's say it's pretty unique, McCarthy, in the situation he's in. Being a first-year starter, even though it's a second year in the league, and he's expected to win right away. That's tough for a guy that, when he was playing in college, I didn't think was going to even be a first-round pick. He was a late riser with his stock to get drafted in the first round. And now they have enough faith in him that after a serious injury, he was the right choice to take over the quarterback race. Are they willing to take a step back, to take two or three steps forward with him? I don't know. That's usually not how the league works.
Ron on our text line says, curious about Cleveland and their quarterback position. I think that is a popular choice. Plus, I'm curious about the second round players holding out on contract signings. We discussed this yesterday. 30 out of 32 second round draft picks have yet to sign their contracts. The two that have, the top two picks of the second round, received fully guaranteed contracts. And I found this on The Athletic after we discussed this yesterday. Quote, most people believe that first-round rookie contracts must be fully guaranteed, but that's not true. Instead, the practice evolved since the 2011 CBA was signed, and only because the unofficial standard in 2022, when every first-round pick managed to sign a fully guaranteed deal. So while each pick has a slotted salary, guarantees are a free market negotiation. In 2024, second-round guarantees cascaded down from 95% for number 33 pick Keon Coleman to just 52% from the round's final pick, 49ers cornerback Renardo Green. This weekend, Chargers wide receiver Trey Harris became the first training camp absentee after NFL Network's Ian Rappaport reported that the number 55 pick was absent from his team's July 12th deadline to report. Reminder, don't call Harris or his peers holdouts. My bad. Since these second-round picks are not under contract, they cannot be fined or otherwise disciplined for missing training camp.
Something to watch. I feel like there'll be a flow right before training camp, but I don't feel like all of them are going
to
sign.
There is one player, according to The Athletic, that everybody is waiting for. Tyler Shuck, the second-round quarterback drafted by the New Orleans Saints.
Mm.
He's got a ton of leverage because Derek Carr suddenly retired.
What are you New Orleans people saying? Your Saints people, what are they saying?
About Shuck?
Yeah, are they gonna give him a guaranteed contract? Come on, we just went through all of this. They colluded not to give Lamar Jackson a guaranteed contract. Why would you give Shuck a contract that's guaranteed?
The Athletic says if the Saints fully guarantee the salary for pick number 40, everyone drafted prior to Shuck could demand the same. While those
you can't,
after him,
in your right mind, guarantee a quarterback who was drafted in the second round. You can't do it.
The Saints may not have a choice, though. Again.
Really?
Who's playing quarterback for the Saints? Spencer Rattler? Oh, God.
Yeah.
I don't love the idea of that.
But do you love the idea of guaranteeing your second-round quarterback?
No.
You can't guarantee his contract. We don't know if he can play or not.
I'm looking to
can
see.
Can you imagine the Titans guaranteeing Will Levis's contract?
Oh, my God.
He was their second-round pick.
He was.
Let's guarantee his contract. I mean, that would be the biggest albatross going. Not that it's a ton of money for a second-round pick, but still.
So Femi Oladejo was drafted after Tyler Shuck. So that's good news if Tyler Shuck gets a guaranteed contract because you hope the guarantees decline as you go spot by spot.
Maybe Shuck will hold out, and then the Saints will trade for Will Levis. And Will Levis will be – that's how the Titans will move on from Will Levis.
Perhaps.
That could be a training camp story.
That could be a training camp story.
And then Will Levis will shine for the Saints – And you'll be sitting here every Monday going, look at Will Levis and the Saints. This is amazing.
You'll be tweeting out, aw, shuck.
I was
just
thinking more.
Right alongside his latest tweet of the Iamaleli drama.
Yes. And in New Orleans, they don't prefer mayonnaise. They prefer a aioli.
Ah, I see.
So if Hellman's makes aioli, maybe Levis could tap into that.
Okay.
I can see it developing. They like a little bit more flavor in New Orleans than just mayonnaise. You know, you got to spice it up a little bit. One texter says, I live down in New Orleans. They love Shuck, but doesn't every team love their new player, LOL? Especially the quarterback. They're like a shiny new toy.
I think people liked Will Levis going into his first year.
Right, but the Derek Carr sudden retirement puts all of the leverage in Tyler Shuck's hands. Unless the Saints are comfortable playing Spencer Rattler.
The owners are colluding right now as we speak.
Literally.
They're
as
going
we speak
back
right
through
now.
All the memos. And they're like, remember these emails we had that the arbitrator said there wasn't enough? Can we recirculate those?
For a second round picks?
No new conversation. I just want you to reread these emails that we had and make your decisions accordingly.
Oh, boy. 615-737-1025. Our phone and text lines are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. We'll take your thoughts on training camp around the NFL. The Titans report to training camp 1 week from today. Get excited. But coming up next, there is a word that GMs in every sport are hesitant to use. That word, to borrow a phrase from my son, is a potty word. It begins with an R. It's not actually a bad word, but it is a bad word when GMs say it because fans don't know how to react to it. But there was a story written about this word that I want to get into coming up next because it's a topic that Willie and I, we've been going back and forth about this for years. And now we have some data to actually discuss it. And that's what we're going to do coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Dunick, Adam Vingan, 1025-1063, The Game.